a cinematographer had gotten sick and couldn't go to Cairo. And they're like, do you want to go? Do you have a passport? It's like in 4 days. And I was absolutely, 100%. I was aware of him. I was aware of the show. And I got to say, at that point in my life, that's like exactly what I was dreaming about. That's exactly what I wanted to do. And I went, and it was like miraculous.
Cinematographer Morgan Fallon had experience filming around the world for television. He had no idea he was in for the ride of his life.
Once you were in with Tony and once he knew you, it was like a lifelong bond. You know, he was incredibly loyal to people. But before that point, you were lucky if like he handed you an empty coffee cup. You were not on his radar until you're on his radar. And so that first show, the first few days, it was just like, just blank stares, you know. And then I think day five or six, we went out to the Western Desert and we were going to spend the night overnight with the Bedouin. And we had like a 20-mile drive across the open desert in these great old 70s era Land Cruisers. Really being young and wanting to impress, I climbed up on the roof of one of these things to film us like going across the desert. And there was an old 4-post bed for some reason strapped to the roof. I think they probably thought Tony was more of a diva than he was. So they had brought this 4-post bed along to go out to camp in the desert. And I just kind of wrapped my arm around that. And they proceeded to go across the desert at, it seemed like 80 miles an hour. It was absolutely terrifying. No sense whatsoever that there was like a human being on the roof of the car. And when we got there, I had a hematoma the size of a football on my bicep where I was holding on to the 4-post bed. And Tony walked right over to me with a huge smile and gave me a hug and a high five.
That trek across the desert brought Morgan Fallon and Anthony Bourdain together. They would collaborate on incredible shows like Parts Unknown and No Reservations. Anthony Bourdain had a talent for bringing together incredible people in unique settings to enjoy local culture and food. He relished new experiences, taking risks, new flavors, and sharing the journey. But before we go to the furthest corners of the earth, let's get to know how the TV personality proved himself in a kitchen. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Anthony Bourdain was born on June 25th, 1956 in New York City. His mother was a copy editor and his father was a music executive. He was raised on lyrics and literature in the suburbs of New Jersey. Anthony recalls his love of food sparking early on in his childhood. While on vacation with his family in France, he was offered multiple opportunities to broaden his palate. He often turned down the local fare to have familiar staples like a burger and fries. One night, his parents left him and his brother in the car while they went for an upscale meal in a fancy restaurant. Bourdain was so fueled with jealousy, he vowed to never turn away an opportunity to try something new. Bourdain attended Vassar College for 2 years before dropping out. He admitted he was more interested in chasing girls and drugs than he was in pursuing academia. While at school, he worked at several seafood restaurants in Provincetown, Massachusetts. The kitchens were filled with tumultuous relationships and drugs, so he felt rather comfortable. These kitchens dragged Bourdain through the school of hard knocks, forcing him to shed his upper-class lifestyle, and inspired him to eventually enroll in the famous Culinary Institute of America in 1978. He started a small catering company with his friend Dimitri and found minor success catering for Provincetown's wealthy residents. But his dreams to expand and refine his craft were consuming him, and he decided to join the kitchen at the Rainbow Room. There he was forced to create hundreds of identical plates while under the hazing environment of the kitchen staff. He gained the respect of his colleagues when he fended off a groping attack by stabbing the offender with a meat fork. When the opportunity to work under a former high school classmate who was opening a restaurant in New York presented itself, he leapt on the opportunity. he brought the playful side of the kitchen with him to cater to his debauched desires. The restaurant owners were naive to the industry, and Anthony took full advantage. The restaurant never achieved success and was forced to close. He went on to work in several fine dining halls run by entrepreneurs. He quickly realized that not many chefs understood the business side of the restaurant industry, and many business people didn't understand the kitchen side of the industry. During this time, Bourdain's drug use increased dramatically. He became addicted to heroin and later transitioned to methadone as a legal and safer alternative. He hit a low point where work was either unavailable or unobtainable. Bourdain's eclectic love of music and films would keep his spirits up and his imagination ignited. His friend and cinematographer, Morgan Fallon, told me about some of his passions.
Goodfellas is a huge one. I think that he considered that, and I've heard him mention this a number of times, that that is probably the most perfectly constructed film. He loved everything, man. He loved every genre of film, with the exception maybe of superhero films. I don't think he was too hot on superhero films. But, like, he loved action films. He loved terrible action films, you know, and he loved great films, and he loved classic films, and he loved, you know, little niche films. There was no pretension about it. He just liked what he liked.
He ran various kitchens in New York City, including the Supper Club, 1 Fifth Avenue, and Sullivan's. The grueling hours and sweat-inducing labor caused his fingers to deform and gave him striking pain in his legs. Nevertheless, he loved his work, and nothing brought him greater joy than creating new dishes to serve to the public. He became the executive chef at Brasserie Lazal in 1998. Anthony's New York Times article, "Don't Eat Before Reading This," was published in 1999. It was a harsh insight into the confines of New York's kitchens and the debauchery they housed. With the article's success and his reputation as a respected chef, he began to stretch his legs into more high-profile culinary projects. He released his first best-selling book, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. The book took the elements of Bourdain's article and went even further. Years of verbal abuse, intense heat, ritual hazing, and torturous hours unraveled page after page. Anthony married his love of travel and food in his book, A Cook's Tour, Global Adventures and Extreme Cuisines. He wrote it alongside his first TV series for the Food Network, conveniently called A Cook's Tour. In 2004, he honored Brasserie Lazal by writing Anthony Bourdain's Lazal Cookbook, Strategies, Recipes, and Techniques of Classic Bistro Cooking. It became a New York Times bestseller. In 2006, he would return to the coveted list with his book, Nasty Bits. With booming credentials, Anthony graduated networks and premiered on the Travel Channel in 2005 with his new show, Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations. The show would take Bourdain around the world, following the unbeaten path to locals' favorite spots. It provided means and reason to expand his taste buds and horizons. No Reservations would be the introduction to what Bourdain would master, documentary filmmaking and cuisine. It ran for 9 seasons and won 2 Primetime Emmys for cinematography.
I remember being in the Caribbean, and it was like the third show of mine. It was like the Grenadines in St. Vincent. And we had like the whole intention of the show was for the crew to have a good time. Like Tony could, he was like, I could give less of a shit about what this show's about. Let's just run around and have a good time. And I want to make sure that every day there's a lot of relaxation time in the schedule. So that was the show. We had like a catamaran. We sailed around the Grenadines. And I remember one night we stopped on the beach. We grilled fish. We like hung out on the beach. We talked. We smoked a big joint on the beach, and I went back on the catamaran. And I remember we all got on the front of the catamaran on the trampoline and put our chests right on the edge, looking out forward, and put our arms out in front of us as if we were like Superman. And as the catamaran's going across the ocean, it felt like you were flying just a couple feet off the water. And I remember it's like sunset, it's a super soft Caribbean air. And it was absolutely delightful. And we were all just like, we were in tears. We were laughing so hard. That was a nice memory.
In 2007, Bourdain married mixed martial artist Octavia Buzia. They gave birth to their daughter Ariane later that year. Bourdain was previously married for 20 years to his high school sweetheart. Bourdain tipped his toe in many things throughout the years. He appeared in several TV shows and films like The Simpsons, Yo Gabba Gabba, Far Cry, The Big Short, Miami Ink, and Top Chef. He also produced and narrated several episodes of the TV show The Mind of a Chef. He was a consultant and writer for the HBO series Tremé, and after the great success of his book Kitchen Confidential, it was adapted into a short-lived sitcom starring Bradley Cooper. He wrote several books over the years, from biographical to crime fiction and a historical account of Typhoid Mary, but he would return to our screens with his masterpiece and best-known work in 2013. Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, was his opus to everything he loved in the world. It was all of his risks, adventures, desires, compassion, and obsession rolled out to be consumed in each hour-long episode. He wanted to experience everything from visiting the South Pole to having bear for lunch with miners 5,000 feet underground in West Virginia. Director and producer of Parts Unknown, Morgan Fallon, loved the kinetic energy Bourdain brought to every episode.
Our perspective was always like, we're going to go in with a really minimal footprint. We're not going to shut down the environment by virtue of our size and our presence. We're not going to intimidate people. We're going to go in with humility. We're going to go in with smiles. We're going to go in with a sense of being gracious. And what frustrations we encounter, those are going to be internalized, and those are going to be used as a propellant for telling the story. And that story is going to come to us through the people, not through our pre-approved treatment. And so that philosophy of lightness and being adaptive and quick, I mean, really came from that desire. And it worked, you know? I mean, people ask me, like, what was the most valuable asset you guys had? And I always think it was, like, a smile. And not just going in hot and demanding what we wanted, but going in and smiling and sitting down with somebody's grandmother and laughing and being willing to be, like, the awkward Americans who don't know anything and let them teach you about who they are and what their culture is. Again, that was... It's hard to even call it a philosophy of Tony's because that has the connotation that it was developed over time. I just think that that's who he was in his soul. I think he understood that that was the way that he wanted to operate in the world and that that was the way that was going to be the most truthful experience in the world.
Parts Unknown was a departure from the format of most conventional travel and cuisine programs. It was shot in more of a documentary style. Bourdain invited us to be a fly on the wall while he guided us to weird and wonderful places we only thought of in our dreams. But in order to do this, he had to get out of the camera lens, which, it turns out, he was quite happy with.
It was never about him. If I was in some blues joint in Mississippi and we're watching, you know, a 90-year-old guitarist play and sing, and I'm filming that, and I turn the camera to Tony watching, he would at first politely and later more forcibly wave the camera off because for him, like, he's like, why, dude, this is not about me right now. This is about this person. This is their moment. This is why we're here. And I think that he really experienced the world that way. And so part of his shyness and his aversion to crowds, I think, was in part that. I don't think that he wanted to be the center of attention, the center of focus. He wanted those cameras to always be pointed outward at the world around us. I think that he was someone who was truly compelled on a very deep level to take that journey and to connect with people and to explore the other. There was some agoraphobia there, which for a New Yorker is kind of an amazing thing. But I think the bigger part was not wanting to be the center of attention, especially when he always felt like he was a guest in the world. There isn't a separation between what you saw on camera and what our life was like when the cameras went off. I mean, there wasn't like a persona of Tony, the TV person, that he turned on. None of that was bullshit. that was real. That was what we were experiencing and what we were going through. So it was very similar to the show, to be honest.
Thank you so much for listening to A Life Lived. We'll be right back after this quick break. This episode of A Life Lived is brought to you by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. For 170 years, it's been covering a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and so much more. Each week, The Economist publishes obituaries on people who have lived remarkable lives. As you'd expect, there's a beautifully written obit on Anthony Bourdain, and also a great read about his fellow New Yorker, Robert Morgenthau, Manhattan's longest-serving district attorney, who lived to be the age of 99. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free copy now by texting the word LIVED to 78070. That's LIVED to 78070. Support for A Life Lived also comes this week from Manscaped. Gentlemen, Manscaped is the number one for your below-the-belt grooming, offering precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. And they've got it all, brother. Anti-chafing ball deodorant, pH-balanced ball wipes, and a waterproof electric trimmer with skin-safe technology so you won't nick or snag your nuts. And seriously, while we're talking about shaving down there, why would you want to use the same trimmer on your face as you do on your swingers? Guys, your little fellas have been crying out for these Manscaped products to keep them fresh, moisturized, and smooth as an eight ball. You already put deodorant on your armpits, so keep the funk away from your junk and start manscaping today by heading to manscaped.com. Once you're there, use the offer code LIFE to get 20% off and free shipping. I've asked the guys here in the office, and they swear your balls will thank you. So what are you waiting for? Get yourself on over to manscaped.com and get 20% off and free shipping using the code LIFE. Anthony Bourdain used production on Parts Unknown to fulfill his childhood dreams and bring them into our living rooms. There was no place, taste, or experience he wasn't willing to attack head on. He believed that the perfect meal was a combination of great food, a vivid environment, and good company. And you can lose good food in a semi-interesting environment, but the company was key.
Going up the Congo River with him, I think that was like, we were really seeing was him living out a childhood fantasy, you know, and like the deeper we got, I think the more he kind of was living out that fantasy. And that's something that was so delightful about him always, is that he had no barriers when it came to indulging this boyish curiosity and fascination and excitement that he had about the world. And so here you've got this person who's done, I mean, really everything conceivably that a human being can do, who would still get giddy, you know, and still giggle and laugh as we're like working our way deeper and deeper into the heart of the DRC. The fact that there were like poisonous moths around that would inflate your face if you smacked them on your face. The fact that we had to basically pull our 70-foot boat over into the brush on the side of the river because, you know, there were some guerrilla groups around who might take us hostage. There were some pirates on the river. I think all of that for him was just really fantasiful. And that was pretty amazing to see him like that, you know?
The show was a tremendous success, winning several Emmy Awards and attracting a great following. But for Bourdain, the show was growing, evolving. It wasn't just about the people and their environment. It was about their culture, their history, and their politics. It was becoming more of a challenge telling their story without getting stuck in.
It was ability to talk about a lot of the things that he felt were important about the world. I mean, you can go around talking about the world, but without being able to talk about the political context or the social forces that are shaping what you're seeing, without talking about the history, I mean, what really do you have? You know, we are the sum total of those parts. And so I think that that was more that it was just greatly empowering to him. You know, we went through the process of like kind of putting the monster together, if you will, right? So we find a piece over here and a piece over here, and we're kind of putting our story together, right? And that's the body of that is constructed of these various scenes that we found, vignettes that we've shot, B-roll that we love, all of the stuff that we captured in the field. And a lot of that is Tony's interviews and verite moments, things like that, right? And then you lay it out on the table, and what we would do, we would send, you know, Tony kind of very rough scratch writing, right? I would say the most intimidating part of my job was trying to write for Tony. You know, he has like, you know, he's a multiple, you know, New York Times bestselling author, an absolutely brilliant writer. So we would kind of temp in this scratch writing that he would then rewrite. And that's what brought that body to life. You'd get that writing, and it was like the lightning bolt hitting and the electricity going through the temples of the monster, and it would sit up on the bed, and all of a sudden it was an alive, functioning, whole creation. It was really his voice. And people talk about his iconic voiceover and writing and his reflections on the world and his humor and his depth of knowledge and information. I mean, that is what was in him. You know, his ability to go out and connect with people and talk to them in the moment was extraordinary. But his ability to sit back and understand what he had seen, understand what the story was about, understand what he wanted to tell about the world, and understand how that related to the greater kind of human context was something truly singular. We will see very few other people in this industry with the ability to do what he did in terms of his writing and voiceover. And so that was really the life of the show.
In 2016, Anthony and his wife announced they were getting a divorce. Bourdain said traveling 250 days of the year for work had not been easy on his wife and daughter, and the separation was mutual. In 2017, Anthony began dating the Italian actress and director, Asia Argento. This was a time when America was in a state of restlessness over the inauguration of President Trump. Whatever your politics or feelings on the subject, it can't be denied that it has divided the country. But Bourdain didn't pass judgment. He wanted to understand. This wasn't an overnight division. Something had been percolating for a while. Morgan Fallon recommended they film Parts Unknown in his hometown in West Virginia and asked the people there what motivated them.
I'm bringing Tony into a town that I'm vouching for, saying, hey, man, trust me, this is important. These people are important. But there's no restaurant there. There's very few open storefronts. Everything that we're going to have to do is different than what kind of the normal modus operandi of the show had been. And I wasn't 100% sure, you know, when we get here, how is Tony going to react to this? And so we filmed the first day, and that went really well. We were with a family in Welsh who runs a food bank for people in Welsh. They feed like half the county in McDowell. They're really just extraordinary people. And then the next day we did a piece about kind of the history and the economics with an extraordinary filmmaker, Elaine Sheldon, who really was like the keystone to the episode in a lot of ways. After that, we went down in the mines and hung out with the miners. They were awesome. And so we got out of that. And I was like, okay, so we're starting to get a little bit ahead of steam, a little bit of momentum, but I still kind of can't read what Tony's take is on this. The crew split off from Tony. He went back to our small hotel, and we went to film a parade, actually a homecoming parade. And then the tweets started coming out. And so my phone went off, and Tony had written something to the effect of, you know, West Virginia, you move me like few other places I've ever been. And I was just, it was this moment where I was like, of course he gets it. Why, how could you ever have questioned whether or not he would get this? This is Tony. He understands implicitly and on like a very deep empathic level, the humanity of what he's seeing. He understands that these people who have no reason to do so because of the way they've been represented in the media for decades have opened their homes and their hearts and their shared their experience. We are coming clearly from a network that has a certain viewpoint. You know, we are a bunch of citified liberals going down into a coal mine and asking about Trump and the election. And we were met with no resistance or hostility or preconceived notion whatsoever. And so I had this moment where I was like, well, of course Tony understands this. And I went back to the hotel and we sat out on the stoop of the hotel and we drank bullet whiskey and talked for a long, long time about what we were seeing and how kind of extraordinary it was. And that was Tony, man.
Bourdain understood that it was the survival instinct and the adaptive spirit that made people and places special. He wanted people to recognize the similarities and values we share. The tenacious business acumen of a Nigerian fisherman who makes next to nothing is not far from the French brasserie with 2 Michelin stars.
We're going to explore like ingenuity and the tenaciousness of the Nigerian spirit through these micro economies and do-it-yourself social structures, you know. And so that leads us to places like Makoko, where an entire city has been built on the water, completely outside of any kind of government control or subsidy or, you know, formal plan. It's just people making it work. Where there was no land, they simply expanded onto the water, ran electricity and built schools and built grocery stores, barbershops, and an economy. Again, from that point, we knew kind of what we were targeting. And that's not to say it's easy, because Lagos is not easy. Lagos is super difficult. The most difficult part of Lagos being that every single neighborhood requires many deals to be brokered with the local area boys and the local tribal leader, local police. You know, it's a very complex web of logistics, or you just simply get shut down. Basically, we just went about 5 days early and went, you know, go meet everyone. Go to every location, figure out logistically how we're going to do things, figure out how we're going to tell the story, make our game as tight as it can be, and then basically just kind of release control once we start shooting. And that's how you feel that organic feel, you know. And this was really a mandate top down regarding the show from Tony, which was, we're not doing second takes. We're not asking people to do things again. If we're not tight enough to get it the first time, then we missed it. And we're not going to go in and tell people what to say. There is no script. We have a general idea of what this person's area of expertise is, and that's what we're going to talk to them about. And so that's where you find that looseness. We also had established over time, like, one of the most like flexible and reactive teams that I've ever seen in television. And so all of those little moments of discovery, Tony would say, oh, like, man, look at that. Oh, like, that's super cool. Oh, we got to follow that storyline. We were able to do that. We were able to be fluid about those things. And so, again, that kind of structure and that understanding that we're not making a feature film, that we're not in charge, that we're not in control of the world, you know, that we are guests, and that all that means is that we need to work harder in order to facilitate the people in the story around us. That was how the show was run. That came from Tony. And that's, you know, again, why it feels real. What I'm super proud of in the Lego show, and I think Tony was super proud of too, is that despite what your feelings are about that show, and it can be a contentious show if you're a Nigerian, and I understand why. No one will deny it. That is what Lagos feels like, that kind of extraordinary energy.
Morgan shared with us the last show he made with Tony.
The last night we were with Tony in Texas, in the Texas show, which was the last show that I made. I was the director on that show. My wife, Jillian Brown, was the producer on that show. So I had her with me. We paddled up into Santa Elena Canyon. And so you're like in this canyon, you have 1500 foot walls on both sides. One side is Mexico. One side is the United States. We shot our scene and, you know, we're talking about border issues and stuff like that with this incredible group of people, guides that had taken us up there. And then we built a bonfire, and we'd always travel with a Bluetooth speaker. Inevitably, you'd start playing music and Tony would kind of shuffle in and be like, hey, let me take control of this. And that was something he loved to do that. He loved to just sit and play DJ, right? And I remember we built that bonfire. We were all drinking Lone Stars and Reposado, and everyone started dancing around this fire, and Tony was playing Kendrick Lamar. The fire was casting our shadows up on these cliff walls, right? So there's this like circular shadows going around these massive cliff walls, and it was just an absolutely magical moment to see him there just kind of with that like sly smile on his face, holding court and playing music. It was really amazing.
Anthony Bourdain committed suicide in a hotel room in Kaisersberg, France on June 8th, 2018. They were on location filming an episode for Parts Unknown. The crew had obtained enough material to air one final season of Parts Unknown to honor the work of Bourdain. One episode would have his iconic narration, while the rest would show his magnanimous journey. Morgan said this was the most difficult project he had to work on, and also the most fitting memorial to the chef, the author, the presenter, the documentary filmmaker, and his friend.
There were, I think, three shows that we had to build at the very end that did not have, you know, any writing from Tony. Trying to construct those shows without that life was a profound reminder of who it was that we had been working with all that time. It was a series of these little, tiny, beautiful, perfect moments. And being able to, like, understand that it was okay, that there were some things that the camera was not going to capture, that there were some things the audience was not going to understand, that there were some things that we, because of the fact that we had spent so many years traveling, that were things that kind of, I don't want to say the only things that we were going to get, but only things that people who've done like really deep travel were going to, I don't even want to say get because it sounds so arrogant, but things that were going to speak to us that were a little bit different than the way it might speak to someone else, you know, for the first time. So to sit out in the patio in Tangiers during call to prayer, during evening call to prayer, and to watch these massive flocks of birds kind of weave their pattern over the minarets, that was something so truly extraordinary and so kind of in this singular little moment that I guess what I'm trying to say is that this experience was many thousands of those and stealing these little moments. And I think there's a tendency to think of it as these broad sweeping accomplishments, like go to the North or go to the South Pole, you know? And it's like, yeah, I mean, that was super cool. But there were little details along the way in that journey that really made the sum total of the experience. And what was incredible about watching Tony is he had such appreciation for that, in that could happen in any environment. There was nothing where the surprise of life and people and experience couldn't catch him off guard. And after all that time, you know, to be able to see the world like that, it just, and that's really amazing. And so when people love the show and when people feel that character of who he was, I think that's a lot of what they're seeing, is like that appreciation never went away. You know, it was always there.
Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations and Parts Unknown are available for streaming online. If you're interested in the show, but you're not sure if it's your cup of tea, Morgan Fallon has this recommendation.
Go down the street to Gray's Papaya and get a hot dog. And if they understand why that is a completely awesome and singular experience in the universe, then they need to go watch this show.
Next time on A Life Lived.
I remember, I think it was the first trip he went to America, and he called me and Angie back in London, and he said, I've just been to the... What's that place? Is it Roswell, where the aliens landed or whatever? He said, and I met somebody, and there is an alien, and he's in ice. He's been put in ice, and it exists. But in those days, to get a telephone call back to England took forever, and it was crackly, and you could hardly hear anything. But so he always had an interest with what's going up there in the sky.
We'll take you on a journey through time and space with singer Dana Gillespie and discover the origins and transformation of the messianic Martian, David Bowie. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.